few years ago, I worked for a church in Inglewood, and I taught a Wednesday night Bible study, and the senior pastor of that campus taught a Wednesday night Bible study, and we had a, I would like to think we had a friendly competition that we would not go public with. I should not even say it now because it's a stained glass secret, but we had a friendly competition regarding how many people were going to be in attendance at the two Bible studies. Yeah, pastors do that sometimes. So I didn't start it, he did. I don't want to say that for the record. He's the one who brought that up, and he played the senior pastor card and that kind of thing. So we went back and forth over that. And I was doing a series on apologetics at the time because I was a seminary student, and I learned very quickly that it's often best for me to learn something in class by teaching it to a class. So I would take that which I would learn in class over the previous week or two, and I would turn it into my lesson that I would teach on Wednesday nights for the Wednesday night Bible study. Then we approached this time of year, and the senior pastor was going to go away on a vacation for about 2 or 3 weeks, and he was doing a series through the book of Romans, and we had discussed his plan for the book of Romans before he started that series. He says, I'm going to do it in about 16 weeks, and I said, I don't believe, I'm not an expert, but I don't think you can cover Romans in 16 weeks. He says, I'm just going to hit a high point from each chapter, so I should only be in each chapter for about a week. I said, what do you do when the stuff from the chapter you just did carries over into the following week? He says, I don't anticipate that happening. I said, look at me. That's going to happen. That is going to happen. I had a few chapters in mind. I didn't say them out loud, but I had a few chapters in mind. Some of these things are going to carry over into the following week. He says, I assure you, that will not happen. So he started his Bible study. I started mine, and he said, I'm going to go on vacation. So at some point before I finish this series, I'm going to need for you to bring your Bible study into the room with my people, but I want you to stick to what I'm teaching. I need you to step away from your apologetics series for a while and start teaching from the book of Romans to the people who are here in my Bible study. And he has that prerogative. He's the senior. So I said to my class, at some point, I don't know exactly when, we're going to stop discussing these arguments for God's existence and this other stuff, and we're going to step into Romans for just a second because we're going to combine the two studies for a week or two while the senior passes on vacation. And then he gets to around weeks 7 and 8, and I notice he hasn't left yet. I notice he's not gone. And so he comes to me right around week 7. He says, okay, my wife and I, we're leaving. We're going to the Caribbean. We're going to Cancun in a couple of weeks. And so I'm going to need you to come in to the Bible study. And I've been paying attention to where he is in this book. And so I said, well, wait a minute. That has me doing chapters 9 and 10. He said, exactly. I said, that's how you knew that you were going to be able to get this thing done in 16 weeks, because those are the chapters I had in mind regarding knocking this thing out. He says, yeah, I know exactly what I was doing, okay? I said, well, here's my concern. What if I get up and I teach that text and they throw rocks at me? He says, I'm going to be in Cancun. If something happens, let me know when I get back. True story. He said, when I get back, let me know what happened. And so I said, okay. And then we all gather in the same room, and I teach through Romans chapter 9, and no one lost it. No one. Not one person said anything to me about it. It came up again the following week, and we rolled it over into chapter 10. And no one said anything during the class. But a woman came to me afterwards, and she says, I want to have a meeting with you as soon as we can. So senior pastor comes back. That meeting has not occurred yet. I tell him what happened, and I said, I was surprised to find out that no one lost their mind when I preached election from Romans chapter 9. And he says, I wasn't worried about it because everyone here is Presbyterian. So they already believe that. He said, they would have thrown rocks at you if you taught anything other than election from Romans chapter 9. He says, everyone here is either Presbyterian or they're Dutch Reformed. They're from Pennsylvania and Michigan. So they came here with that understanding of that passage in place before they even got here. I said, there's one person who has an issue with it, and I have a meeting with her the following day. He says, you tell me how that goes. And by that, I mean, if it goes poorly, don't say a word to me about it. And if it goes great, now come here and I'll celebrate it with you. That's a quote of what he said. So she comes to my office, and she sits down in front of me, and she plops a book on my desk. And let me stop here. Don't give me books. Do not give me books, okay? Listen, let me tell you what bibliophiles do not want from you. Books. Don't want books from you. You can buy a gift card, and I'll go get a book, but don't buy me a book, okay? For a couple reasons. Number one, My experience has been that oftentimes when someone brings me a book that's good, I probably already have it. And now I have two. So keep that in mind. The second reason is, often when someone brings me a book, it's a very careful way of quietly rebuking me on something that I have just taught. And I would much rather you come into the office and we have a conversation about it versus you putting it down on a table and giving me homework. Okay, that's the second thing. The reason I mention that is my agenda was to have a conversation with her about the issue she had with what I said from Romans chapter 9, but that's not what we did. Instead, she says, nope, everything's here. You should read this book. Now, the title of the book was Why I Am Not a Calvinist. For the record, election is typically associated, as I taught it last week, is typically associated with a theological camp known as Calvinism. And there's an alternative camp known as Arminianism, which teaches a much more free will action of humanity. We're responsible for the process. Don't worry about that, the details of the names. Jacobus Arminius are the people, and John Calvin are the people after whom those two camps are named. Calvinism, election, and Arminianism, much more freedom of the will, that behavior. So her book was Why I'm Not a Calvinist. Now, I said to her, yeah, that's a good book. It's a good book. I read it already because I have it. I already have that book, so you can go ahead and keep that one. And I said, did you read the other one? She said, there's another one? I said, yes. There's another book that came out on the same day as this one, published by the same publisher. In fact, there are two volumes. There is a set. And the other one is Why I Am Not an Arminian. And she said, why would I read that book? Why would I read that? I said, why wouldn't you? Why wouldn't you read it? And she said, I hate what's taught in the Calvinist camp. Why would I read a book that advocates for the Calvinist view? I said, you have just answered your own question. If you're going to evaluate something, it is your responsibility to familiarize yourself as best you can with the tenets of the idea. Otherwise, you're going to find yourself setting up a straw man and knocking it over on behalf of someone else. You're going to misrepresent the alternative view. She says, no, I fully understand this. And because I fully understand it, I can reject it on its face. I said, great. So we can have a conversation about this, and we're going to be talking about the same thing. And she said, yes. So I said, so tell me your issue with election as it is addressed in Romans chapter 9. I'm going to get to the passage in a minute. Tell me your issue with it as it's addressed in Romans chapter 9. She said, I do not want to worship a God. Listen to this. I do not want to worship a God who will, number one, send someone to hell against their will. And I do not want to worship a God who would drag someone into heaven kicking and screaming. I said, neither of those things are in that text. I said, you really need to read the other book. Neither of those things are in the text. What you just did is misrepresent the Calvinist view, and you argued against ideas that they do not espouse. That's a straw man. You want to be careful of that. It's an argument of fallacy. You want to be careful that you do not misrepresent your opponent's view. Here's what election from a Calvinist perspective teaches. None of us, from the moment of our conception, want God. None of us. It's in Romans chapter 3, before you even get to chapter 9. Paul's been setting you up for Romans 9 for the past 7 chapters. None of us. He says in Romans chapter 3, there is none who seeks after him, no, not one. We have the venom of asps under our tongues. From the moment of our conception, we are at enmity with him. I have told you this a million times. You need to stop telling everyone in your testimony of the day when you came to Christ. That never happened. You did not come to him. He came and got you as you were running, willfully running away. He came and got you. Now, even when he caught you, which is ridiculous, the fact you were running away, even when he caught you, he did not drag you into the kingdom kicking and screaming. No, he gave you eyes that allow you to see him for who he really is. And when you see God for who he is, two things will occur. You will be awestruck with fear for the holiness of God, and you will be overwhelmed that you have that type of access to a loving, benevolent person who seeks you out by name. It's what theologians call the mysterium tremendum, the fear of God, and the mysterium fascinandum, the fascination with God. So he's a mystery that both terrifies us and fascinates us. And the balance has you taking him seriously, and yet you're drawn to him. He didn't drag you, he let you see him. And when you saw him, you wanted what you saw. A few years ago, we were at City Park with Reese. Reese was about 4 or 5 years old. And a person who a household who attends the church, they were at the park as well. It was a church picnic, and they brought their dog to the picnic because Colorado. And when we got there, it was not a small dog. It was a massive dog. It was a Great Dane, and my daughter, she looks at the dog, and she had never been that close to a dog. Period. Because daddy don't do the dog thing. And she had definitely never been that close to a dog that is that big. The dog was taller than her. As far as she knew, it was a barking horse. It was huge. We're talking about a dog that weighs 140, 150 pounds. A huge dog, okay? But the dog's very friendly. Very, very friendly dog. As friendly as dogs, never mind. So she's very close to the dog. She's very small. She may not have even been that old. She may be about 2 or 3 years old, okay? And so she's standing really close to this dog. And I noticed something. She wants to touch the dog, but she is terrified of this huge dog. So the entire time she was like this. In fact, I was standing nearby. I was like, listen, I'm not going to help you on this one because I don't want to be anywhere near him, so you on your own. But she was drawn in and yet terrified. She was awestruck and yet fascinated. She was afraid, but she had to go get him. When you get a glimpse of who God is, two things should happen. You should be terrified by the holiness of the God you see. And you are drawn in, fascinated by the God you see. It's why Isaiah chapter 6 is the legit text. Because they get a glimpse. The angelic beings are flying around the temple. And they're flying in the presence of God. And they sing repeatedly, holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is filled with his glory. And angelic beings who have never sinned a moment in their lives in the presence of God, they have a fascination with him that has them singing a song of praise over and over again every day of every year of every millennium of every moment in the since the moment of their creation. They stand in the presence of their God and they revere him according to who he is. But I promise you, they do not treat him like a plaything. I'm a fan of the idea of I am a friend of God, the song, I am a friend of God. Here's the problem with it. We end up treating God like he is the friend, and he is therefore demoted to where we are, and he is able to be handled by us according to our good pleasure. And that is not how this works. The reason God being our friend should fascinate us is because he is the one who spoke the universe into existence. You have a friend who has Genesis chapter 1 on his resume. You should stand in awe and fascination. They coexist. You don't pick one. And when he gives you eyes to see him for who he is, you are terrified and yet drawn to him. It's not dragging. It's not dragging. It's a new heart. It's what theologians call a quickening. You know what John chapter 3, verse 16 says? I'm hoping you've seen it. If you've ever been to, if you've ever seen a football game on television, someone was holding up this banner behind the goalpost, okay? And it's this whole thing, God so loved the world, he gave his only begotten son, so on and so forth, okay? I want to say this for the record. I would argue the reason I choose a Bible that doesn't have red letters in it, because I would argue that Jesus is not speaking in verse 16. I would argue that. I would argue that the conversation between the two of them, Nicodemus and Jesus, is 1 through 15. And then John jumps in, providing commentary on what Jesus just said in verses 1 through 15. Because Jesus is explaining to him, you must experience a new birth. And Nicodemus is confused. How can I be born twice? How does that happen? And so John jumps in, gives you commentary. Here's what Jesus is saying there. From the moment we are conceived, we are in death. And therefore, we cannot see God for who he is, and we do not want him. And then you experience what theologians call a quickening. It's when he gives you life, and it allows you to see God for who he is, and therefore you want him. And in that passage, Jesus refers to that as being born again. It's a new birth. In other words, when we say the words born again Christian, we are often using language that's redundant, because you will not experience conversion unless you experience that quickening, that new birth that allows you to see God for who he is. And on the authority of Romans chapter 8, verses 29 through 31, I would argue that everyone who experiences that new birth converts to him. Everyone. There will be no one in hell for all eternity saying, man, Jesus didn't listen to me. No, he did. And that's how you got here. That will not occur. Everyone who is in eternity is experiencing either deliverance. This is very important. This is how I want you to think of heaven, hell experience. Everyone in eternity is experiencing deliverance from what they wanted for all eternity, or they're experiencing the curse of receiving what they wanted for all eternity. God delivered you from a desire for a world that did not have him, or if you're a non-believer, he gives you a world without him. And that's hell. You don't notice it until you get it, because in time, everyone's experiencing this constant mingling of heavenly and hellish. Everyone is. Dr. Evans says this. He says, everyone who's a believer in this room right now, you are presently experiencing the only hell you will ever know. And everyone in this room who's a non-believer, you are presently experiencing the only heaven you will ever know. Because in eternity, it's his unfettered access to God. And in eternity, if you're a non-believer, it's hindered, absolutely hindered access to God. It's removal from him. You spend your life saying, God, I don't want you. And God says, the punishment for all eternity is you do not have me. And no one will be in that condition against their will. No one. So what does Romans chapter 9 mean? How does this make sense? Well, look at what he says starting in verse 14. I turn the page. Romans chapter 9, verse 14. This is what Paul says. What shall we say then? Is there injustice on God's part? By no means. For he says to Moses, I will have mercy on whom I have mercy, and I will have compassion on whom I have compassion. So then, it depends not on human will or exertion, but on God who has mercy. For the scripture says to Pharaoh, for this very purpose I have raised you up, that I might show my power in you, and that my name might be proclaimed in all the earth. So then, he has mercy on whom he wills, and he hardens whomever he wills. Now, I want you to read that passage in light of what I just told you, okay? The thing I just told you is, you are actually born hardened. So here's the image you should have. It's an act of grace that he softens your heart, allowing you to see him for who he is, and therefore you're drawn to him. And it is an act of justice that he passes over and doesn't soften your heart, allowing you to see him for who he is. it is not injustice to anyone. The only one in the whole scenario who gets the short end of the stick is God. Because everyone in creation gets either mercy or justice. And for us to receive mercy, he had to absorb the justice in his body crucified on a cross so that he could afford mercy in your lives so you can experience deliverance that we do not deserve. Now, I want you to take note of this in verse 14. He's actually answering a question that he anticipates they're going to ask, because they're going to ask him, wait a minute, God, how was it fair for him to pass over some and give mercy to others? He says it very carefully in verse 14. He says, what shall you say then? Is there injustice on God's part? By no means. How was that fair? I want to make this very clear. Do not get into a conversation with God regarding fair. You don't want to? You don't want to do that. Because if you want fair, then the penalty is fully on you. The penalty will be fully on you. I was at a restaurant for a meeting. It was a coffee shop for a meeting a few weeks ago. And there was a family adjacent to my table. They were just maybe 6-7 yards to my right. And so I was sitting on this side of the table. The person sitting on that side, and their table was over here to our right. And the entire time I took note of something. They sit at the table, and the mother asks one of the children, what do you want to eat what are you ordering for your meal? And he took forever because he was a kid, and finally figured out what he wanted. Mom bought precisely what he wanted, and it was some stuff he probably didn't need. I think he had like some sugar with a side of sugar, and he washed it all down with a glass of sugar. And so that occurred, and then a few minutes later, he decided he didn't like what he told her he wanted. So then they have the server come take it away. And the mother was very apologetic, the boy was very apologetic. They took the food away, and he ordered a new thing. True story. He decided he didn't want the second thing that he ordered. Now, you got to realize where I am. I'm sitting over here at my table, and I'm minding my business. As best I know how. And I'm saying to the person in front of me, it's killing me. This is killing me to not say anything, you understand? I'm having a hard time over here. He said, I can tell it's killing you. The third order comes. He eats into it, decides he doesn't like that, and then he decides to throw a fit in the restaurant. And I mean the kind that I did not know existed. I thought it was on TV. I have never understood this, because you understand where I come from. I can say this with genuine face, I have never thrown a tantrum publicly, privately, or I have not been in a room by myself with the door closed in the dark and stomped around the room all by myself, just me and the Holy Spirit. I've never done that. Never, because if my father suspected that occurred, it was going to be a problem. If I do it in public, my father has a policy. I will never forget this for as long as I live. His rule was, if you do it here, this is where I'm going to deal with it. I said, you're not going to go to the restroom? Like, you didn't do it in the restroom. If you do it here, this is where it's going down. That's all I know. So I'm looking at her, I'm like, oh, I said to the guy in front of me, I said, listen, I think it's about to go down. I think it's about to go. And then she leans in. Reggie. And he stands up and he looks at her eye to eye. And she says to him, when you get home today, no video games for you. I said, no video games. If I were him, my thumbs wouldn't work. That's a non-issue. My father would break my thumbs. And he looked at her, having sent three meals back, and yelled at his mother. He said a few words that an adult should not say, let alone a child to his mother. And he finally got fed up with the punishment for his behavior. He says to her, "That's not fair." And the ice couldn't take it no more. So I lean over. I said, "Man, if we were going to get you fair, I would have handed my belt to your mother about 10 minutes ago. You have not received fair. And trust me, you don't want fair. Because if it was fair was coming your way, she would have thrown hands with you a long time ago. Because you called her names that I would not call a murderer." You don't want fair, boy, because that won't go well for you. The next time you stand in the presence of a holy God who is maximally put off by sin, and you challenge him to give you fairness, I need you to stop for just a moment and reflect on all the stuff that he delivered you from, endured, put up with for the entirety of your life. And you remember, he put up with, we're not talking about sending back meals. We're talking about you laying up with someone who you don't even know. We're not talking about you calling somebody names. We're talking about you using your name to blaspheme a holy reigning king. And in that moment, he did not strike you eternally. In that moment, reflect on that and say, he passed over all of that. When you cry out for fairness, remember that if he gives you fairness, then the profane language you used toward him before, and the fact that you were laying up with someone before, and the fact that you mishandled someone before, and the fact that you lived a life that idolized other things and other people, worshiped things other than him, all of that is now on the table, and he needs to drop the hammer on you because he's a just God. Instead of giving you justice, he gave you grace, and you messed around and obligated him to justice. He didn't harden us. We are that way from the moment of conception. And he decided to soften some and to leave some as he found us. Now, for me, the response to that is very vocal, very emotive, celebratory outbreaking. Because he came and got me despite me. Yes. He could have passed right by me, and he didn't. Now, that answers one of the questions. Another question that came up was, what's the point? If that is true, then what's the point of us preaching the gospel? Okay, listen to me. The fact that he has elected some for salvation, and their salvation is therefore sure, it is a motivation to preach the gospel. It is not a hindrance to the call to preach the gospel, because he has chosen us to be the means by which he will go out and retrieve his elect. In eternity past, he didn't just choose the person who would enter his glory. He chose you as the one who would go and receive the elect who are going to enter his glory, which is why in Romans chapter 10, he says, how will they hear without a preacher? Missions cannot fail because God has already done the work ahead of the missionary. He has gone to that mission field, and he has already established what is going to occur here. Our job is to merely be the vessels of it occurring. We are to go and receive. We are to seek after, go hard after those who God has already identified as the called and elect and chosen, and the ones who will be glorified. We are to go and receive them, which means you have to preach the gospel to everyone indiscriminately, because you do not know who that is. You do not get to walk down the street and say, you know, he don't like God would want him. You don't get to do that. You preach the gospel indiscriminately. And then God brings fruit to the words of your mouth. When I was in college, my first semester, I had a roommate with whom I did not get along. Can you imagine that? You put me in a small, confined space with a stranger, and it didn't go well. I can't imagine that happened the way it did. And he and I just did not get along well at all. And he would do things like he went hunting, and he came back, and his boots were muddy, and my bed was near the door. My bed was near the door, cousin. And he came in, and he did not want the muddy boots over near his bed because they're muddy. So he stopped at the door and took the muddy boots off at the door. So his muddy boots were about 6 feet. It's a dorm room. They're about 6 feet from my head. And so I said to him, hey, listen, brother, Broham, I need you to, and that's what I said, I'm quoting. I'm trying to tell a story here, okay? I need to get your boots. I need to get these smelly boots from this close to my head. He says, I'm going home on Friday. He lived in DeSoto, which is south of Dallas. He says, I'm going home on Friday. I'm going to take them with me when I go home. I said, brother, it's Monday. You think these boots are going to stay here all week? He says, that's not that long. I said, then put them over there where you are. He said, I can't. They're dirty. I said, what are you doing? And so I said to him, listen to me. When I get back from class, I need these boots. I need these boots gone. And I get back from class. He's still at 8 o'clock. I get back from class. He's still in the bed. Boots still there. And I said, listen, I have a class at 11. When I get back from that class, I need these boots. I need these boots gone. And he says, okay. And I go to class, come back around 1 o'clock, boots still there. Okay? The next day, they were there overnight. The following day, it's Tuesday, he had left the boots there overnight, and I said the same thing to him the following morning after my 8 o'clock class, and these boots gone. And he said something different that time. He says, you're not my father. And I said, I know. Because if I were your father, this would not be the same conversation that we've been having for the past 2 days. And then I go to class, and I had a subscription to the newspaper when I was a freshman in college. My father worked for the Dallas Morning News, and they would deliver the paper to my P.O. box the day after it came out. So I would get the Tuesday paper on the Monday paper on Tuesday. And I stopped at the P.O. box on the way back to the dorm. I walk into the dorm room. The boots are still there. I have a bag on my shoulder and a newspaper in my hand. And I said, you didn't get these boots up. And he said, I told you, you're not my dad. And he walked away from me. And I'm not saying, I will neither confirm nor deny smacking him in the back of his head with that newspaper. I'm not saying I did that. All I know is I blacked out, and then there was a loud sound, and then I came back into the moment, and he was looking at me shocked with his hand on the back of his head. I don't remember. I will neither confirm nor deny. He immediately, the door was still open from me walking in, he immediately runs out, goes to the end of the hall, to get our RA, whose name was Nick. Here's the problem. I went to high school with Nick. So Nick comes, and he says, what happened? And I point the boots out, and he says to me, Brandon, you can't hit him. I said, okay. And then he moved out. And then my next roommate moves in, and word got out that Brandon hits his roommates. And he says, listen. And my next roommate was a believer. And he said, listen, I'm not going to leave muddy boots over by your bed. I know you don't like that. I know you don't like that. And he says, I want you to know that I'm a follower of Christ, and I'm going to be praying for you. Okay? I said, all right. And I wasn't a Christian at the time. I said, no, as long as you and Jesus have an arrangement where these boots won't be over here in this corner, then you and Jesus and I, we good. Okay? And then the semester goes by, he moves out, not because he hated me, we had a good relationship. And then one day I get saved in the interim over the summer. And then I go to Family Christian Bookstore in Dallas, and he worked there. And I walked in, and I see him working there. And I said to him, hey man, hey, I accepted Christ a few months ago. I need to ask you a question. Why did you live with me for months? And you never once mentioned that Jesus summarily confronted my sin on the cross. I'm on my way to an extremely bad situation eternally. And you were sleeping in a bed 12 feet away, and you had the remedy, and you never said a word about it. He said, I just didn't think that anyone who would hit their roommate with a newspaper would be recipient to the gospel. I said to him, you don't get to choose. Who's going to hear the message? You don't know who the elect are. You preach the gospel indiscriminately. It is also our responsibility in that world to give them a foretaste of the eternity that they can anticipate. We are the ones who create a, and I'm giving you a heads up on 11 and 12, 10 and 11, chapters 10 and 11. We are responsible for creating in them a virtuous jealousy because they see us living kingdom people in a kingdom way under a reigning king to whom we have full access. We put that on display. You don't just give them the message. You give them a display of the life that came out of the message. Now, let me say this really quickly, because I will hear people say this all the time. It says this whole thing, like, preach the gospel at every given opportunity, and when you can, say something. Listen to me. We got to stop saying that, okay? Because no one's going to look at your life and say, I want to accept Jesus. I mean, just look how he's walking. No, you have to say something. Just be sure that the life you live does not undermine the thing that you say. So have a life that reflects kingdom, and then you tell them about the kingdom. You give them the message, and then you live according to it. And the combination gives them a foretaste of the thing that they can anticipate, and it creates in them a virtuous jealousy. They long for the thing and the person that you have. It's giving them a glimpse into the future they can have. We weren't here last week because we were in D.C. Denver Seminary had a board meeting in D.C. So the whole board went there for our meeting this past week. And we had not been to D.C. before. And I told you that it's a practice of, many of you were here when Bobby Manning preached for our 10th. And I said it's a practice of his to take his children on trips with him. He'll take one of them at a time. And I have a child who's a D.C. kid. Like, she, Reese does not want to go to Disneyland. She wants to go to D.C. I don't want to have ride on rides. I want to see history before me. So I said, Reese, Dad is going to D.C., and you can go with me. And Bobby Manning lives in Maryland. So I said, I have a few meetings while I'm there, so you may have to hang out with Pastor Bobby and Levera while I'm there. And so, but other than that, you and I are going to have a whole lot of tour time. And then Sheree finds out about that, and she says, nope, you're taking Ellis and Mama with you. So all of us went to D.C. And I get there first. I get there a day before them, and I'm already seeing all the stuff that Reese is going to lose her mind over. You pass by the Washington Monument on the way to our hotel, which was downtown. Our hotel was at 1331 Pennsylvania Avenue. You could see the White House from our hotel. You can see the Washington Monument from everywhere, but you can see the White House from our hotel. I did not know it was that close. On our second day there, we leave in the hotel and we went to the African American History Museum, which is right next to the Washington Monument. And as we're leaving, I noticed the White House. It's right there. It's right there. I didn't even tell the kids yet. So on that following Sunday, we went to church, went to First Baptist, we was in Prince George, we went to PG County. I thought about you the whole time, and I was like, okay, I get it now. It's fly, it's okay, I get it. I'll talk to you later. We had a good time in Prince George County. We went to First Baptist Glen Arden, and after that, we got back, changed clothes, and I took them on a tour of that circle. So we hit the Washington Monument, and we saw the Capitol building, and we walked over to the Lincoln Memorial, and we walked from the Lincoln Memorial to the White House. So you want your children to get a glimpse of this history that we've been talking about this whole time. And Ellis tried to push the Washington Monument over. He says he thinks he moved it a couple inches, and Reese did not realize the Lincoln Memorial is that big. It was a great time. I love seeing the awe on their faces. They were so tired by the time we got to the White House. Their response was, okay, look, it's a building. It's white. We're good. Where's the hotel? They were done for the day. And I figured they're so tired, they won't care about anything tomorrow. But the thing we had planned for the next day was a trip to Howard University. And we won't go to Howard because when Reese was about 10, 11 years old, she She did a marathon viewing of A Different World. And she came to me and she said, "Daddy, is Hillman a real school?" And I said, "No. In fact, when you see the external shots of that, that's the campus of Spelman, and most of them are Morehouse." And she said, "Okay, is there any school like Hillman?" I said, "Girl, please." Okay, so I said Spelman and Florida A&M and Hampton. I'm not going to give her every school. I told her the one she could choose from. And you have Hampton and you have Howard, and I gave her a few more. She went and did research on all of these schools, and she found all these people who graduated from Howard. And she fell in love. I may be indoctrinating her, but she fell in love with Howard. She's like, "Wait a minute, Daddy, did you know Debbie Allen went to Howard?" I said, "Yes, I did. Felicia Rashad went to Howard." I knew that. Thurgood Marshall graduated from Howard Law School. I know that. I'm the one who gave you the list, okay? Then Chadwick Boseman delivers the commencement speech 4 or 5 years ago, and Ellis is watching it with her, and Ellis says to me, "Wait a minute, Black Panther went to Howard." I said, so while we're there, one of the things we want to do is catch an Uber from our hotel over to Howard, and we did an informal walk of the campus, and I have pictures of the kids there, and that we were walking into buildings we probably shouldn't have been going into, and it was a good time. And I could see Reese envisioning A Different World, Spelman College, that you could just see it happening. Okay, I'm about to cry. Okay, so, and then we get home. The kids are in Texas right now. And then Reese calls me the day after they get there. She calls me the night before we go to bed. And she said, "Daddy, now that I've been there, I want to go even more." So here's what happened. A 12-year-old envisioned something theoretically. And then she was exposed to it. And it gave her a foretaste of what she could actually have one day. And when she got that foretaste of it, she longed for it even more. Are you tracking with that? We had this walk with this moment, and we didn't get to encounter a whole bunch of people. It's summer, so we didn't get to encounter a whole lot of people. All she knows is she sees bisons everywhere and these buildings that look really old, and they have carved in front of them on the front the thing that's being taught in that school. So she sees the building of fine arts, and she sees the sciences building, and she sees the chemistry building, and she sees where the building where they teach philosophy. There's a building where that's called the education building. She said, "It's a school. Of course they have an education building." I said, "No, that's where they teach educators." She said, "They have a school just for that?" I said, "Yes. Howard, baby." And it stopped being this thing that she was imagining, and it became a tangible thing. The foretaste gave her a glimpse of what it could be. Are you tracking with that? And because she had the foretaste, she wants to be there. You are the foretaste of the kingdom. And Paul is telling you in Romans 9, 10, 11, and that's going to make more sense in a couple of weeks. He's telling you in Romans 9, 10, 11, that it is our responsibility to give the world just a taste, just a glimpse of what eternity could be. You do not have permission to decide who gets the taste. They're to hear the message from you, and they are to get a glimpse of the kingdom by watching you. And in doing so, you put the values, the character, and the virtues of our King and his kingdom on full display. You preach the message verbally, and then you live the life daily. Let the mysteries of election remain mysteries, because all you know is God told me to go and make his name famous in all the earth. And that's something we can comprehend. Be on task. Now, we're not done in Romans chapter 9. I wish we were. But we're not done in Romans chapter 9. But this is what I want you to walk away with. You are the ambassadors of the kingdom that put the message on display. Live according to the office that you hold and make our King known and famous in a world that desperately needs him and is on their way to an eternity without him.